Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Okay, today, we're going to talk about the four great vows, to be sure, but I want to talk first about the bodhisattva and the idea of a bodhisattva. What is a bodhisattva, and what in particular is something very important to me, the bodhisattva ideal? The bodhisattva itself, the idea of the bodhisattva, is an ideal. That teaches us something about where this practice of ours is going, where we are going in our practice, and also what this practice is about. For the first few hundred years, maybe 300 years, 400 years of Buddhism, what was the ideal? Huh? Who was the ideal? Let me put it that way. The Buddha. Duh. That makes sense. And the Buddha, who practiced diligently, left his family, went and got awakened himself, and then at the end of his life, he entered nirvana. And without going into that deeply, he got off the wheel of rebirth. He got out of samsara forever. And that was the ideal. This idea of rebirth, you know, some of us might think, well, that sounds all right. I might get reborn as a great baseball player next life. That was not the idea back then. The great big chance was that you were going to get reborn as a caterpillar or an ant or somebody in the hell realm. And even if you got to be a god in the god realm or the deva realm way up there, they had their own problems. They were too lazy in the god realm, in the deva realm. They were always arguing with each other. There were lots of problems, lots of ways to go wrong. So better to get off the wheel altogether. The word nirvana itself means extinguished. So, again, won't go into a long thing about that. Extinguished, basically the fire is an image that nirvana is connected to. The fires of desire are extinguished. And you can rest. Samsara, you know what samsara means? Elizabeth Bitter, you know. No, you don't. Anybody know? Literally? It means?
Suffering.
No. Yeah, you would think it means suffering. It means wandering. It means wandering. You can't rest. Wandering from life to life in the old school. So, then around 100 BC, there's this new ideal that comes up. The Bodhisattva ideal. And starts to take hold in certain schools of Buddhism. And eventually it supplants the Buddha in many of those schools as the image of what we're working toward. The Bodhisattva was a term that was in use all the way through, but what the Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva means something, we'll get into that, but before, the Bodhisattva meant one thing, and that was the lives of the Buddha before he became a Buddha. So, over and over again, the Buddha had to go through many lives before he got to Buddhahood. And before he got off the wheel. So it's, if we're bodhisattvas, we're on our way to becoming a Buddha, but we're not there yet. So we're all bodhisattvas. We're all working toward that Buddhahood. And there's another element of this bodhisattva ideal, and that is, that develops, and that is that not only are you working toward Buddhahood, but you will never get there. Well, not never. You will, you promise that instead of entering Nirvana forever, you will get to know it and hold the door open for everybody else. And you won't, you'll be the last one to go. So you will get there eventually, but everybody else has to go first. So you are forever, in that way, you are forever tethered to the world. You're always interested in everybody else getting there. So it's kind of like a captain of a ship, you know, the last one to leave a troubled vessel. And instead, you'll help everybody else get in first. And that ideal, you know, it means something to me. It has meant something to me emotionally over the years. Because it tells me not to dream of a life that it of enlightened ease. It tells me that to forget about the dream of a simple life. Maybe you have that dream. If only I could have a simple life. And we kind of have a simple life here for a little while. But what the Bodhisattva ideal tells me is don't think of that as a fixed place to go. That I just want it to be simple. You will always, if you follow the Bodhisattva ideal, you will always come back to complexity. You will always come back to suffering. You're always going to come back to the messy world. You're not going to forsake that. When I went to Mount Baldy Zen Center to begin with, when I was 20 whatever years old, I really did, in the back of my mind, have that ideal of a simple life. I had this book called The Zen Way. I wonder if you know that, Wes. It's a black and white book of pictures from the 1960s, my grandfather's book. No, The Zen Life. And it, those guys look so cool. Every one of them looks chill, you know, just together, calm. And that's what I wanted. Later, after I got there, I realized, yeah, you get some of that, but you get a lot of other stuff too. That I had not bargained for. Later, somebody gave me a book called Unsui. Some of you know that book. It's a cartoon book, and it shows the life the way it really is in a monastery. You know, with every picture, the monks are going. You know, even in zazen. You know, so it's the real life, and that's. The bodhisattva life, really, like that we're practicing, but we've got our feet on the ground. We're never going to leave this messy world. We're going to stay connected to the joys and the sorrows of the world, no matter what. We vow to do that. We're not leaving. We're not giving up on the world. So for me, that means, in fact, leaving the world, like we just did. Leaving our family behind, leaving all of our problems, our 108 problems, all of them, and coming to a place like this and doing the best we can to discover another world, to discover Nirvana, in fact. And when I say Nirvana, I mean the world of peace, where we can just be without any trouble. But when we get that taste of nirvana, we know when we begin that we're headed back. We're not going to stay. We're going back to the world later. And that's my job as a practitioner as I see it. It's to leave and to come back to the world, to the messy world. And in samsara, when I'm in samsara, not to always long for the world of nirvana, and when I'm, but to make the world and its problems my practice. It's important to me to learn. I'm trying to learn to go both directions. Gladly to go gladly toward nirvana and then turn around and go gladly toward samsara without hesitation. So to energetically go, walk to the world of nirvana and leave that other world behind, and then walk directly back into the world of suffering. I think it's possible, you see, for practitioners to get caught in a kind of purgatory between those two worlds. I mean, I feel it myself. So, too cautious about finding nirvana, not really willing to let it go, to let everything go. It's a real commitment. It takes energy, and it's a real commitment to drop everything. To go to the world of nirvana means, you know, plainly, from my point of view, to die to yourself, to let all that go. That takes some work, some commitment. I mean, come on, you showed some commitment by signing up for this retreat. So that's these retreats are not easy, and I really appreciate that. But then it's also possible to hold on to the cool and calm and collected self that we find here. And when we go back to the world, you know, be in some way removed from the suffering of others, kind of protect ourselves. And that I see as too attached to the world of nirvana. It's possible to be that too. And a bodhisattva is not. A bodhisattva is comfortable in both worlds. That's the important thing about a bodhisattva, is from my point of view, and the bodhisattva ideal. And is not afraid of either one. Can move directly into either one. That's my ideal. A few weeks ago, Dr. Tim Lenz from the University of Washington came to give a talk at the Zen Center, and he said, some of you may remember that, he said he thought the very beginning, he's working on the early Buddhist manuscript project, and he said he feels like the beginning of the Bodhisattva as an ideal was these descriptions of the Buddha in a previous life making a vow, he said. Making a vow. They had previous life things, but the turning point was when they made a vow to become a Buddha. So that vow was integral to the Bodhisattva ideal. The vow to attain awakening for the benefit of everybody. And that's the way I see a vow. It's a sacred determination to do something, in this case, to achieve awakening for everybody's sake. And that original vow turns into our four great vows. We chant them every day, so you'll get used to them if you're not used to them already. Today I'm just going to talk about the very first one, which a lot of ink has been spilled over. This first one is the one that most, as you can see, actually, in both of these, number one, is talked about most. Number one, beings are without number, and I vow to liberate them. Beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. And liberate in other translations is save, as I think in at least one of these. Yeah, maybe both. Save, free, or take to the other shore. So I think the first thing I'm just going to touch on is, what are we liberating folks from? Any thoughts about that? What are we liberating them from?
Samsara.
Yeah, from samsara, from that wandering. I think that's right. And the mark of samsara, at least one of the primary marks, I think, is suffering. Dukkha. Remember the class, the Roots of Buddhism class? Dukkha, the word dukkha, which is the mark of, the main mark of samsara, has a whole bunch of definitions. Suffering is one, but it could be a lot of different things. From gross suffering to much finer things like unease, existential unease, angst. So I think that's the Bodhisattva's mission, is to relieve people from that kind of suffering. And maybe you're right, Brian, maybe it's, you know, to relieve people from samsara, I would say temporarily, because again, we're going back to samsara, but to know another world, to know that there is another world out there, this nirvana world, which is not out there but in here, to know that, that's another thing I think we're relieving people from, is the ignorance of that world, that there really is another way to be. Most people don't feel that. That there is another way to be. And finally, I think, I'll put this in here because it's right at the heart of the Heart Sutra, from fear. It says, the middle of the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva lives without walls in the mind, I can't remember exactly how it's put here, without walls, without barriers, and therefore without fear, when they really understand. We are in the liberation business here, and I hope you can find some liberation today. You're probably tired today, but maybe tomorrow. Feel some, lightness. Really, that word liberation works. I mean, some openness, some liberation of your burdens. Yeah. And we do that by here, by dropping our thoughts as best we can and inhabiting this present moment, and feel the lightness, the unencumberedness of that present moment. And that's why we do things over and over again, just settling deeper and deeper and deeper. I hope that for you. Today, tomorrow, the next day. And then we can begin to feel a kind of freedom. Ironically, because we're stuck here. But the kind of freedom of possibility that does not exist when we're locked in, when we have a rigid and fixed perspective. Freedom to inhabit an unfixed perspective. And I hope you won't only feel this here, but when you go back as well. to the world. So, the liberation of others, I vow to liberate others, it says, that starts with the liberation of ourselves, I believe, roughly speaking. And that's what retreats like this are for. But what does Huey Ning say? He says, oddly, you can't really liberate yourself. Huey Ning doesn't do the liberation. He says, our own original enlightenment does that work. Now, this is a subtle point that I'm just going to touch on. But the way I see, the way I connect with Huey Ning's comment, and this is Huey Ning's kind of shtick. That's not putting it right. That is one of Huey Ning's primary points, is that it is original enlightenment and realizing the original enlightenment that will do the enlightening in other places as well. The way I connect with that is I feel that to do this work takes our will, does take initiative on our part. We sign up for the Dhamma retreat, come down here, and commit to, as I said last night, you know, commit to paying attention to something other than what we normally pay attention to. And that takes our will and the kind of cleaning away of the clutter of our lives. It takes effort to really, truly leave our home. So not just physically, but also psychologically. And to find a new home, which is this present, not just this place, but this present moment. And to me, sometimes that feels like takes a lot of energy, you know, even just to get your affairs tied up at home, you know, and then get down here. It feels like a rocket ship leaving the earth. You know, your home is the earth. Someone told you there's a really great world up there. You should go see it. So you know how a rocket takes so much energy at first, with all the flames coming out. And then you get past the atmosphere and you can float. It's much easier. And just a little will get you moving in a different direction. It takes less effort. And then, this is the feeling I have, when you get closer to that other world, let's call that nirvana perhaps, that other world that somebody told us about, I feel that world has its own gravity. And that's what I think Huey Ning's talking about. That world, and see if you can feel that, that world pulls you to it. When we get really quiet, or when we begin to get quiet, we can feel something else at work. We don't have to effort it as much. We can feel pulled toward it. The feeling I have, you know, of course this is just a metaphor, but the feeling I have is that it wants to be discovered. That aspect of ourselves wants to be discovered and helps us along. So Huey Ning says, it does the liberating in the end. Okay. As we begin to liberate ourselves, I think that and gain a certain peace of mind, I really do think that that has a liberating effect on other people in our lives, other people that we meet. And I think that's the main way that Buddhism works. and helps. Not by converting other people, but by influencing other people by the way we act. And that doesn't mean, so therefore we're not going out one and one and one and one in so much as, though that I don't want to say that in a blanket way, because that can be part of practice too. But everything that we meet, we have some effect on everything that we meet. In our families and workplaces and travels. I think about, sometimes when I say something like that, I think about Zen Master Ryokan, who lived alone in a hut and never gave a Dharma talk in his life. He wrote poetry. He was a great poet. One of the three, most famous, I'd say three or four most famous Japanese masters. And so though he didn't preach, he had this effect on other people. So I'm going to read you something that somebody wrote back in the day. He lived in the 1700s. Ryokan stayed with us for a couple of days. These are some lay people. A peaceful atmosphere filled our house and everyone became harmonious. I'm not promising this, but it's kind of an ideal, at least one type of ideal. We don't all have to be Ryokan, but here's one possibility. The atmosphere remained some days even after he left. As soon as I started talking with him, I realized my heart had become pure. He did not explain Zen or other Buddhist scriptures, nor did he encourage wholesome actions. He would burn firewood in the kitchen or sit in meditation in our living room. He did not talk about literature or ethics. He was indescribably relaxed. He taught others only by his presence. He taught others only by his presence. There are different ways to teach people, I think, but that is one way. And that's an important way. And that's one of the things that this practice is about, to be sure. A couple of us have also, just to code it to that, a couple of us have read this book about, that I found, some minister gave to me, about family systems theory and building a healthy church, how to do that. And the author makes a lot of leaders having a less anxious presence. This is Christian minister talking. That having a less anxious presence when working with problems makes a big difference in the system. There are ways to affect the world and to help liberate beings. Let's go to the second one here, Tori. And Dibi. Oh gosh, I forgot. I'll bring it tomorrow. I forgot to bring the notes that I have on Dibi. But Tori is very famous. Tori Enji. He wrote The Inexhaustible Lamp of the Zen School, and Tori was Hakuin's primary successor. He wrote Hakuin's biography. He lived with Hakuin. He wrote this very well-known book, The Inexhaustible Lamp of the Zen School. That's the first part. Dibi is less well-known. He wrote a big, thick book, which is a commentary on Tori. That's the way we do it in Buddhism, commentary on commentary. Now I'm commenting on Dibi. And I wanted to put that in there because I particularly appreciate Dibi's way of looking at the Four Great Vows. And he says, he says he's updating it. And for him, helping, saving, liberating means helping beings attain their fulfillment. You know, sometimes I think of it as reach their potential. And I think that if we can help people feel less fear, know something besides samsara, I think that we can help them reach the function natural to them, and help them fulfill their lives more elegantly. So I think the Bodhisattva ideal puts our practice, in a wide context. We're doing it not only for peace and happiness, but also for a broader purpose and meaning for other people. We do this practice not just to benefit ourselves, though it does help us, I think, but to benefit the whole. And in some way, to benefit the whole world. And to benefit everybody that we meet. One other point, kind of last point I want to make about this first one, is that it says, beings are numberless, and I vow to liberate them. And implied there is all of them. It's, you know, the rhythm of these four is, this practice is impossible, and I vow to do it. But all of them. And that's a lot of beings, and a lot of different kinds of beings. Ones that we might like and ones that we might not. And the meaning here for me is that we should try and get in the habit of being inclusive in our liberation, in the way we help, the way we meet people as best we can, to be broad and magnanimous. I've often said, you know, it was a very imperfect place where I trained, Mount Baldy Zen Center, but we had this custom rule that people that if you could come and follow the rules at the training center, you could stay, and it didn't matter what your past was. It didn't matter if you had a criminal record. It didn't matter if you were trouble. If you could come and follow the rules, you could stay. So that meant, you know, an interesting mix of people at times. And it meant a lot of headache that we wouldn't have had to gone through if we'd have been a little more selective. And I could tell some stories. Joey probably could too. But we live in a world now that well, I guess we've always lived in this kind of world. But, you know, there's a tendency to say, well, we're the good ones and they're the bad ones. And my team is good and your team is bad. And the Bodhisattva ideal says, or my type of person is good and your type of person is bad. And the Bodhisattva ideal says, we've got to work with all kinds of people. I saw you on TV. Yeah, I did, Jean. Because I was away for Pramila Jaipal's town hall. She came to the high school. She's our U.S. representative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She came to the high school, and I told my daughter, you really ought to go. I was away in a foreign land. And but guess what? Thanks to my son, partly, there was a live stream of that town hall. And he was instrumental in getting that whole thing started. And so I watched it. Recorded actually, but I went through the questions looking for my daughter. She was not there, but Jean was.
You didn't see the singing at the beginning.
I did. I sure did. Yeah. That was fun. Yeah, it was fun. I don't know if you remember this, Jean, but someone asked Pramila whether there was any working across the aisle, whether that was even possible these days. With Republicans. And she says, you know, it's hard. But she listed a good few things that she'd done with people across the, including with a fellow named Mark Meadows, who makes the news sometimes, you know, and oh dear, oh my. And you know what she said? She said, you know, my belief is you can never count anyone out. And then she said, well, I might count a few people out. But she said, my husband is a Buddhist, and he tells me I can't count anybody out. That's an effect. That's an effect. So she says she'll keep working. That's the Bodhisattva spirit. I know her husband. I know him pretty well. We've had a few chats, and you may know him too. He came to the Zen Center. You all remember that? Mm-hmm. And gave a talk about being a Buddhist in Washington. Really nice guy, Steve. Well, we've got an ideal. The Bodhisattva sets us an ideal. We are all Bodhisattvas already. We're working toward awakening, toward realizing our true nature, toward realizing nirvana, and then taking that realization back to the world.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.